Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the show, I'm speaking with the best-selling author, attorney, and entrepreneur, Mina Harris. Mina's road to entrepreneurship started back in 2016 when she began selling t-shirts printed with the words "Phenomenal Woman" to raise money for organizations that support women like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood. Today, the Phenomenal brand has expanded to include a slew of activism-focused campaigns and products like Phenomenal Voter and Phenomenally Black, plus an entire media arm of the business, Phenomenal Media and Phenomenal Productions, amplifying the voices of a wide range of underrepresented communities. But back before she was building an empowering brand of her own, Mina actually worked at massive tech companies like Slack, Uber, and the early days of Facebook. She was also a practicing lawyer, specializing in consumer protection, data privacy, and cybersecurity. And did I mention she's also a children's book author? Her most recent book, Ambitious Girl, came out on January 19th, and it is tremendous. Mina does so much and inspires so many, and I can't wait for you to hear her journey. Now, on Second Life, it's Mina Harris. All right, Mina, you ready to do this?
I'm ready.
Okay, so we like to start at the beginning on this podcast. So what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Oh, you're really starting at the beginning.
Yeah.
All right. So I studied American Studies after trying like four other majors and I just couldn't stick with anything. I tried poli sci, I got bored. I tried sociology, I got bored. I did art history, which I actually really enjoyed, but that ended up like not sticking. And then I finally found this incredible major. It's called American Studies. It's interdisciplinary, which essentially means that you can like take whatever classes you want in any major, so long as they somehow tie back to America. It was basically the perfect major for someone who couldn't land on a major. So I majored in American Studies and then I minored in poli sci. What did I want to be? It depends on the age, right, at which you would ask me that question. As a kid, I would have told you that I wanted to be an artist, and I would have told you that I wanted to be on Broadway. I wanted to be a Broadway singer.
Really?
And yes, absolutely yes. And I will never forget these incredible commutes to school, and I'm like blasting my Phantom of the Opera CD, and I'm singing at the top of my lungs on the way to school. So anyway, yeah, I wanted to do that. I think at a certain point, I don't know if I had ever said, like, I'm going to be a lawyer, but I think I always felt like, okay, I'll probably go to law school.
Okay, so American Studies means that you can take across any major as long as it somehow ties back to America. Do you remember any of your favorite classes or things that you actually still think about or use today?
God, what classes did I take, like, in my actual major? So here's my real answer. I did not go to class very much. I figured out how to make school work for me. But yeah, I did not go to class that much. And instead, I spent a lot of time in East Palo Alto, which was a neighboring or is a neighboring community to Stanford, working in the community there. I was working with an arts program that was all about exploring the process of mural making for community empowerment, beautifying your community through the process of mural making, building community through the arts. You know, a lot of my other memories from college are I was like making and selling earrings. I was making and selling earrings and selling them in like little boutiques around the Bay Area, which is all to say that like I was very entrepreneurial. Oh, I also had like seven jobs on top of all of this. Okay.
Wow.
I was a note taker. I was an RA. I babysat. I was a paralegal.
What?
I mean, it was out of control. I like kind of did everything except go to class, which I know maybe even sounds obnoxious because obviously, you know, I went on to law school but I think I just like, I figured out how to make it work for me. Right. And like did what I needed to do to get A's and, you know, do well in school. But yeah, I was not super like academic.
But you did well, and you did well enough that right after graduation, you started working at a little company called Facebook. So you did well enough to get that job, just saying.
Well, okay, wait, I have to pause you on that because like I remember, so I had it in the back of my head, like, okay, I'll probably go to law school, right? Uh-huh. I had all these incredible role models of public interest lawyers, right? In my family. And that was very much something that inspired me and was something that I intended to sort of follow in their footsteps, but it was also sort of path of least resistance for me, right? Like it's sort of all I knew. And at the time when I went to work at Facebook, I was kind of procrastinating on law school, you know, but most of my classmates senior year, right? They were preparing for the LSAT.
Yep.
They were, you know, intending to, you know, go to law school the next year, the year after. And I don't know, I just like, I wasn't ready, you know, to further talk about how I was a little bit of a slacker. Like all of the super high achieving students at Stanford wrote a thesis. Mm-hmm. I did not do that, which is like shocking to some people. Like, oh my God, he didn't do. Nope.
When would you have had time in between your seven jobs?
No, literally. Exactly. I was like, I don't want to spend time on that. That is not a priority for me. But this relates to the Facebook thing because I remember some of my classmates finding out or like, you know, me telling them that I was going to work at this little social, you know, what people back then were calling these like social networking companies. And what I had to tell people, you know, it's like MySpace, right? It's like MySpace, but it's Facebook. And I remember some of my classmates were like, Mina, what's going on? Like, well, you're kind of fucking around. I thought you were supposed to go to law school. Like, what's up, dude?
Like looking down on you.
No, totally. And we're like, what are you doing? Anyway, so I say all that to say, like, I was fresh out of college, not to diminish, like, yeah, it was awesome to work there. It was a life-changing experience, but it was something that I really intended to do as kind of like, not a gap year, but like my year off before really going off to law school. And I was going to go for 1 year, and 1 year turned into 3 years. And at the end of that time, I eventually went off to law school. It was not something like some impressive thing where I was like, I want to work in the tech industry and I'm going to try to get a job at Facebook. Like that is not how that happened.
Still, I'd like to point out that your gap year, which by the way, is when people travel or do something fabulous sounding, your gap year or 3 years was to get a full-time job at a tech company. Like that's not exactly slacking. So what did you do at Facebook? What was the job like? What were your responsibilities? It sounds like it was very early days.
Yes, I worked on the, what did we call it back then? I think it was called user operations. So it was basically, it's basically customer support. You know, we did some testing of new tools, right? We were kind of like the non-engineer, right? Guinea pigs who were like giving feedback on new tools. It was wild. I mean, I remember the days when you had actual people responding to inquiries from users, typing out a response from beginning to end. Like we didn't even have automated responses back then.
What?
And also, I mean, the biggest, most dramatic thing that happened in my early days there was we launched Newsfeed. So, right, Newsfeed, which we all know now on all these platforms is like your feed, right?
Yeah.
We had launched it for the first time and people went ballistic. Like people were pissed. And the reason why it was drama is I'm going to get these numbers wrong, but imagine it's something to the effect of the team was used to getting like, I don't know, 1,000 tickets a day or a couple hundred tickets a day. And when Newsfeed launched, we got like 36,000 emails or something crazy. You know, so just to really frame just how early it was and how different things were back then in terms of just really early days of this new technology. So it felt, frankly, like an extension of college, which I think, you know, is maybe also a preview of what a lot of kind of culture in tech companies feels like. And that's not always a good thing. It also overlapped with my work on the Obama campaign, which also kind of felt like college. So it was almost, it was like this like fake first working experience, which is nothing like what it feels like to work in, you know, corporate environment that I also later worked in. So yeah, it was a wild, wild experience, especially to look back on.
What was the biggest learning curve? And also, I really believe that we learn certain skills early in our lives. Sometimes we don't realize that we're learning them. So I'm curious if there was any takeaway from like things that you learned at that point in time or started to develop that you still use today.
Yeah, you know, I think especially now that I'm an entrepreneur and doing my own thing, I think, you know, developing sort of tolerance for the unknown, being open to new experiences, being nimble to adapt to different experiences or sort of, you know, environments, especially ones that are constantly changing and shifting. That, as I've seen sort of later in life, can be very hard for people if you have not spent time at that early, you know, stage startup environment, right? It's yep. nuts. And for me, I think it really appealed to me because there's an element of that that is kind of inherently entrepreneurial, right? Like yep. I remember one of the big things that I tried and ultimately failed at was we were trying to start a politics team. This is how early it was, right? Like, of course, they now have a huge politics and like government affairs team and all this stuff, but like we didn't have that. And I was involved in politics in, you know, my personal life. And mm-hmm. we had just launched Pages. Mm-hmm. And I just remember thinking, like, this is such a great tool for politicians. This is such a great tool for, you know, nonprofit organizations. And I remember it was so early where people were wary. I mean, this is also kind of interesting to look back on this, right? Like people yeah. were like, oh, Facebook's that new social networking tool that's going to like expose all my privacy and like all of these, which is, by the way, maybe people were onto something, but I saw the ability to use it for what we now know as like digital organizing, yep. right? And what was super cool about my experience is that although Zuck was like, no, we're not focusing on that. And there, you know, there's a lot to that and mm-hmm. why they made the decision for not, you know, focusing on it at that moment in time. I got to sort of still do it, but through the Obama campaign, right? And mm-hmm. I think that campaign really showed for the first time, you know, how you can use, you know, social networking tools and technology to organize and to, you know, build a campaign around, right? And to get to see that from the perspective of both the inside, right, of working at yeah. Facebook, the tool that everybody was using, but also on the outside, being on the campaign, leveraging those tools, that was really extraordinary.
So you spent, as you said, about 3 years at Facebook before you went to get your law degree. So obviously that was a bit of a road to decide to get there. What was that time in your life like? How did you come to that decision? And did you have a plan for using that law degree? Or were you just going to see where it took you?
Yeah, my whole, like, it was just kind of a somewhat of a miserable, tortured experience of like the LSAT. I just remember that. And I took it the first time and I didn't get the score I wanted. It was like this awful rainy day. It was just, everything was bad. I was sort of like, oh, I didn't want to do that anyway. Like, why are you forcing yep. yourself to do this? And so I took a break from it. I remember the way I studied for the LSAT the first time, I shared a one bedroom apartment with a Facebook engineer. His bedroom was in the living room. Mine, I had the bedroom and it was just my mattress on the floor. And I would get off of work and I'd sit on my mattress and try to study. Yeah. Pro tip. Terrible studying environment, right? Like I was not set up for success. And, you know, sure enough, I did not do well. And I remember, so I kind of took a break. And I think in that period of time, I was like, do I even want to do this? Should I go to business mm-hmm. school? And this is as years were passing at Facebook, right? I gave myself space. I came back to it. And all to say, I took it again. I got the score I wanted. I then applied to law school. I think going into it, I just sort of knew I wanted to do it, but no, I didn't know entirely what I wanted to do with it or sort of why. I think I had this general sense, both from the Obama campaign as well as what I saw growing up, which was that it was a tool that you can use for good, right? On the Obama right. campaign, I saw it in the context, especially of, you know, voter protection. Obviously, those are mostly lawyers. You know, the candidate himself was someone who, you know, used his law degree for good and community organizing and then later, you know, to run for office. So I had some sort of sense that I might do something like that. I very much at that time sort of ascribed to this notion of, you know, a progressive prosecutor and the idea that you could do good from the inside with those mm-hmm. tools. I definitely have a more evolved view on that now. But the point is, like, I went in with sort of a general sense of I can use this for good. I want to do social justice. I want to make a positive impact, especially in the space of racial justice and criminal justice. But yeah, I mean, I ended up doing something totally different. Along the way, this feeling of like, oh, should I have gone to business school? Oh, should I have been doing creative stuff? Is this right for me? That was constantly kind of tugging at me. And I remember, and maybe this was just kind of feeling exhausted from the LSAT and that whole process and feeling a little bit doubting myself. But I remember going and saying, I'm not going to even take the bar. Like, I'm not going to be a real lawyer, right? I'm just going to use this and figure out, you know, other ways to do good with it. But
by the way, like, you went to Harvard Law School and then you're not going to take the bar? Like, oh my goodness.
I know, it's insane. But it just goes to show that I always knew in the back of my head, like, this isn't quite right, you know? Like, yeah. I always yeah. knew it. And I stuck with this really, you know, traditional path because that's what I knew. And I hoped that one day I'd be able to kind of, you know, pursue my dream, so to speak. I didn't know what that looked like. In the meantime, I was like, let me get this law degree. Hopefully that'll set me up for success. And I kept going on that kind of traditional path.
So you took a job as a judicial law clerk at the DC Court of Appeals. Mm-hmm. Was that the dream? What were you exploring? What was that like? Did you like it?
So my experience with clerking is it's something that is considered, you know, prestigious. It's something that a lot of law students want to do after law school. It's almost like an apprenticeship. You're working directly with your judge in, you know, very small quarters, and it's a very intense experience. It's one people literally tell you if you hated law school or if you didn't like law school, do not clerk. And I was like, okay, I didn't really like law school, but let me just try it because people say that it's like good for you and maybe I'll develop some skill. And so if I had listened to that, I would not have clerked. Mm-hmm. Clerking was one of the most transformational experiences of my career, clerking and practicing. And had I not done it and sort of exposed myself to something that on paper I would have said, eh, not for me, I wouldn't have had that experience. And there's just so many incredible things that it did for me in terms of confidence in my writing, reasoning, being able to make good arguments, doing, you know, research, my relationship with my judge, who's just one of the most brilliant, special, kind people, one of the best bosses I've ever had. I mean, it was just such an important experience for me. And it really prepared me for succeeding in my law practice and being set up for success to go into my law firm. And the big, funny, amazing part of it is this is around the time that I started my little t-shirt that preceded Phenomenal. And just speaking to how amazing and supportive my judge was, like, he's so brilliant and nerdy in the best way possible, but he was so supportive of me. And, you know, it's like, it was a provocative shirt that had like a curse word on it. And the fact that he even like knew about it right now still kind of makes me cringe. But I was doing shit like that on the side while I was clerking. And it's just, you know, it's just funny that that stuff always kind of kept coming back in some way, the creative sort of entrepreneurial stuff.
You had to make things, Mina.
I did.
So after clerking, you actually practiced law as well, specializing in consumer protection, data privacy, cybersecurity. What in the world made you decide to make that leap? Did you like the job or that part of law? How did you end up there, Mina?
So I went into my law firm thinking that I would do white collar law, which is what a lot of people do if they expect to like leave the law firm and go into public interest, either, you know, becoming a public defender or a prosecutor. And I quickly discovered that that was not going to be for me. And I'm grateful that I quickly identified that and decided, all right, got to find something else. This is not going to be the thing. I was strategic in that I had spent a good chunk of my, you know, early professional years at a tech company, at Facebook. And privacy and cybersecurity were at that time still sort of a new-ish area of the law. You know, always wanted to do things that are trendy, on trend, and sort of new, interesting spaces. And then also there was a connection back to what I had already been doing. The work was advising tech companies on consumer protection, cybersecurity, and data security. So if I'm being honest, part of me was like, all right, when I leave this place, I need to figure out how to weave all this together. And I had the experience of working at a tech company. I knew the technology. I knew that space. And so I was able to bring that perspective to the work that I would be doing, which is, you know, outside counsel advising tech companies. And by the way, you know, some of my biggest clients were, you know, people like Facebook. And then the other aspect of it is it's regulatory work, right? And that's something that is somewhat unique to DC. It's not litigation. It's not, you know, like corporate M&A work. It's just sort of a different way of practicing. And that was also very appealing to me. I did not like doing doc review. I did not like litigation. That's something else to figure out. And I think the lesson is expose yourself to things that you think you may be interested in, but be open to the outcome of that being that you decide you don't like something, right? It's just as important to figure out what you do like as it is to figure out what you don't like.
So skipping ahead, you were there for a few years trying to figure out next steps. What made you decide to take a leap and go to Slack?
So I was sort of coming up on my 3 years at my firm. Mm-hmm. I remember, I will say, I went in saying, all right, you're not here to make partner, you know, to be here for the rest of your life. What is your plan? How are you going to talk about this on your resume or, you know, kind of connect the dots when you leave? And to me, that was like 2 to 3 years, maybe 4 years max. By the way, if you stay at a law firm longer than 4 years, like you need to start thinking about, you know, being on the partner track, or it just doesn't make sense to be there. So that's also sort of a standard way of looking at that. And, you know, I was coming up on my 3 years. I was not, you know, particularly inspired to continue. I had this whole thing of, do I move to New York and kind of, you know, go to the New York office of my law firm for a couple months while I figure out, you know, my next step. And ultimately, it was too much of an unknown for me to take that leap. And so I kind of stuck around DC for a little while longer. My idea was, okay, let's wait to see what happens with the election. If all goes well, you know, Hillary will get elected. And I think I might be interested in potentially going into government. Then kind of unexpectedly, I was recruited to Slack. And the funny thing is, number one, I was recruited to Slack and I was hoping that I would go back to DC. Like I knew that I had to go to California and start off at HQ. But our initial goal was that I would ultimately go back to DC, potentially like help to open up the DC office. Like I was not planning on staying in California. And I think one of the other key learnings I'll share is that as outside counsel at my law firm, I had insight into what it looks like to be in-house, right? An in-house lawyer at a tech company. And that's yet another thing that I was like, oh, not for me. So when I decided to go into this tech company, I knew I do not want to be in-house counsel, that I do not want to join a legal team. But what I did instead and what I was recruited to do was policy, right? And again, that's sort of more aligned with my regulatory practice. The other key thing is that it was still not like what I wanted to be doing with my life, right? I was still doing like data privacy, cybersecurity work inside of a tech company. And it was, again, a really valuable experience to be there and in those early, early days. But I quickly was just like, oh, I'm doing the same shit. Like, I don't want to be doing this, right? And again, the question for myself was, do you want to be doing cybersecurity for the rest of your life? And I could have answered that question in that moment years before immediately. No, I do not. Absolutely not. But yet, I still kept falling back into this sort of traditional path because I didn't yet know what else was out there or like what would speak to my true sort of passions.
So in keeping with your story, you also had something going on the side, which was in 2016, you also started your brand Phenomenal. So tell me about the impetus for starting this brand. And you were still full-time working, right?
Yep.
See, that tracks for you, Mina.
I know. God, it's a trend. So 2016 election, of course, Hillary did not win, you know, tragically. And I was at Javits Center on election night and it was just awful. Oh. And I remember waking up the next morning just like, oh my God, what just happened? All the headlines were like, will women ever break the glass ceiling? And will women fight back? And what are women going to do? And it's just like, oh, here we are once again, right? Like, and the answer is, of course we are, right? We're strong, we're resilient, we're phenomenal. I mean, it was a wild experience in that we had my now older daughter was like 8 months old. We really went back and forth with whether or not we wanted to travel because we'd already been traveling. We were exhausted. And literally like 48 hours before, I was like, we have to go. We don't want to look back on this and regret that we didn't share this historic experience with our 8 month old, right? Of witnessing the first woman president to be elected. And of course, that trip turned into something much different, which really was providing moral support to my mom, you know, who had been a part. I mean, it was just crushing. It was awful. I woke up just like not only feeling that, but also feeling a fighting spirit of got to get back up and put one foot in front of the other and keep going. And I also personally, if I'm being honest, felt a little regret, wondering if I could have done more, you know, to prevent that outcome. And it's actually interesting. The first thing I did was not the t-shirt. And instead, literally the first thing I did, the moment I got back, we flew back the very next day. We were in New York for like 24 hours. And I had bought do you remember Pantsuit Nation? The whole genesis of it was like women coming together, coordinating pantsuits, literally wearing pantsuits on election day. I had bought a brand new Democratic blue pantsuit for election night. And I was back in San Francisco and was walking to my local dry cleaners to literally cleanse myself of like that moment. And I had this thought of like, wow, what a privilege to own a pantsuit, let alone a brand new one that I bought for election night. You ostensibly have this entire group of, you know, I think it was like 4 million members at that point, right, mm-hmm. for Pantsuit Nation. Like, what if we yeah. started a pantsuit drive as a way to honor Hillary and her public service and also, again, give people something to pour themselves into to feel like they're doing something in a moment that really yeah. was just grief. And it was amazing. We organized this pantsuit drive. People were sending in, you know, their pantsuits from all over the country, and we were donating them to Dress for Success for poor and homeless women, you know, seeking jobs, right? That lasted, I don't know, like a month or something. This was November. And then the Women's March was in January, and I was not able to go. I had my baby and I wasn't able to travel, but I wanted to be a part of it. And so I made these shirts. I thought it would be a fun, not fun, but uplifting thing, right? That felt just like being a part of the moment in terms yeah. of celebrating the women who came before us, women mm-hmm. like Maya Angelou, who made it, often Black women who are powering and leading, you know, these movements, who made it possible for that historic moment that was, you know, the Women's March. And I sent them off with a bunch of my friends who were going to the march, and they all wore them. And I have these photos of them on the mall wearing the shirts, right, at the march. Mm-hmm. And they, you know, got a lot of positive feedback. And it was just these really inspiring images of people wearing the t-shirts. And I thought, let's keep this going. And if you remember back then, there were a lot of just ordinary folks who were stepping up, you know, hosting personal fundraisers for the ACLU, for Planned Parenthood, organizing within their own communities. And I thought, you know, let's create a little fundraising campaign, again, focused on women, launch this for Women's History Month. We'll launch on International Women's Day, and we'll sell shirts to raise money for women's organizations. And it was literally supposed to be, that's it. That was it. Well, 1 month fundraising campaign. And, you know, the rest is history. The first day, I thought we would sell like a couple hundred shirts if I, you know, bugged enough people. And we ended up selling 2,500 shirts on the first day. And, whoa. You know, that is when my sort of both entrepreneurial as well as political organizer intuitions kicked in, which were like, wow, how do we grow this, right? Clearly, it's something that yeah. people are responding to in this moment, at least, right? How do we keep it going? And so we kept it going. And here I am over 4 years later, still talking about it. And I never, ever, ever thought that I would be.
So I met you at South By in 2017, when we spoke on a panel together, and that's when I got my t-shirt.
Oh my God, this is crazy, because that's also, I don't know if you know this, we did a pop-up before launch where we brought a bunch of women together to like take portraits, right? So that we would have all this great content for launch day, which was International Women's Day. But South By was my very first like real pop-up at an event, and we had the whole photo studio. That's so crazy. You were there for like day one.
I have a photo of us on stage. You're asking the audience who in the audience is phenomenal. And I'm raising my hand.
Oh,
and then you later like
God.
Made a joke. You're like, I love that I have this photo. And I'm not even raising my own hand, because you were like so engaged in the moment. Like, I got my t-shirt then. Obviously, you hadn't been around very long. So I remember seeing the whole launch of it. And wow. I am so curious, though, like, it's one thing to make a t-shirt for friends and family or to do something small. Like, I mean, it was a big run, 2,500 shirts right off the bat. Mm-hmm. Were you thinking about, how do I figure all of this out? Or were you just going with it? Did you have money set aside for this new business?
No, I had no idea what I was doing. I had like literally a box of shirts. We were basically invited to South by this women's organization. And I was just like doing, right? So I showed up, and I had been going to South By for years, right? Especially with all yeah. the work I was doing with tech companies. So I was used to going to South By, and I thought, okay, why don't we bring our pop-up like on the road? And we ended up selling the shirts really fast, and people loved the yep. pop-up, which I knew that they would, because we kind of tested it for launch. If I, as I mentioned, right, we did this like mini pop-up in Brooklyn before launch day, and people loved it, right? Part of that was seeing what we were tapping into, that they were like, you know, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to come together with other women in such yep. a powerful, empowering environment of being photographed by a female photographer wearing the shirt and feeling that confidence. I mean, it was just beautiful, right? And so we're like, let's try to keep this going. Anyway, I remember like selling out of the shirts on the first day and frantically trying to get the t-shirt printer to like ship us more. because we didn't have enough shirts and we were there for like 3 days, you know, like shirtless. I think it was like Friday to Monday or something. Yeah, that's so crazy. And I mean, like, how amazing is it that you are literally there for day one?
I don't know. It's happened to me a handful of times in my career when, and look, I've been an editor for 20 years. My mm-hmm. job is literally looking at things and picking what's going to pop and mm-hmm. what's going to resonate and what will make people feel emotions about someone or something or an idea or a film or whatever it is. And it was just one of those things. It was so obvious to me that this idea of Phenomenal was going to be something major. And it was exciting because, I mean, the energy that surrounded you in that moment was just remarkable.
Yeah, that was wild. Things just blew up. And I had this moment of like, F it, I'm just going to run to this thing. And not to be corny, but I really felt it deep in my heart where, and I'm sure you can appreciate this also as an entrepreneur, my joke is like, not every good idea is worth quitting your day job for. And true. I can give a concrete example of that, which is my shirt that preceded Phenomenal that I was doing as a clerk, as a law clerk, and at my law firm. I had so many dreams of like, could this be a thing? Could this be my business and like the thing that takes off? And absolutely not. No, that was not the thing that I should have quit my job for. And I'm so glad that I didn't, right? However, with this Phenomenal stuff, I just felt it. And it wasn't just that people were clearly responding to it. It was also just, and again, what often is the case for, you know, enabling people to take that leap, which is there's a lot that goes into it, right? I had mm-hmm. financial security. I had career stability. We've talked a lot today about kind of, you know, checking boxes, frankly, and doing what I thought was sort of prestigious or would be viewed as successful or accomplished from the outside world or on my building my resume, whatever you want to call it. Like, I was like, all right, I'm good. If I take, you know, these 6 to 8 months and just go with it and it doesn't work out, I can go back and I'll be fine, right? Like, there's so much that went into that moment, but I just knew. And I was like, all right, this is the thing that I really need to run to. So I left Slack. I was doing Phenomenal full time. But we had this whole pop-up strategy, right? Like, that was our next thing. And South By was the first one that you were there for. And then mm-hmm. we did a couple others. And as well, there was a perspective on women in tech. If mm-hmm. you recall, there were a lot of issues around that. Obviously, these issues still exist today, but around generally culture and women in tech and with Uber, right?
Yep.
And we were doing a bunch of pop-ups at tech companies. We did, you know, I think our first one was at Pinterest. We did Google. We did all the tech companies. And it was beautiful. It was like, you go there for a day, you host this pop-up, you bring women together, you do the portraits, you create sort of this community experience. It was amazing. And then Uber comes along, and both credit to them, and perhaps unsurprisingly, they were very into the idea. They were having, you know, issues at that time around culture and in particular with women. And I remember actually people saying like, what the hell are you doing working with Uber? I will never forget this. And I had a very principled feeling in response to that, which is, yeah, I hear you. But the reality is that the women that are working in these companies are, for the most part, like not going anywhere. And a lot of people were canceling their partnerships with Uber, right? Saying, you're not getting this right. We can't work with you. And I get that and I respect that. But there's also a feeling of, well, what about all the women that are still at the company? You can't just throw your hands up and walk away. Who's doing something about that, right? I mean, obviously, ideally, the company itself is. But like, I just saw the headlines of that and I thought, well, gosh, they still need your support. And, you know, as like maybe seemingly insignificant as this thing was with our pop-ups, it felt like a way to support and to create positive community for women who were continuing to work, you know, at these tech companies. So, as I said, we had done sort of one-off pop-ups. Uber wanted to do a whole pop-up tour. And we did a partnership with them where we did like 5 cities. And it was amazing. It was amazing. We hosted panels. I think we did like Atlanta, New York, DC. And it was the pop-up paired with a panel, you know, discussion that was loosely around sort of, you know, women in the workplace. And again, sure, none of that means anything if you're not changing your policies and practices. There's a lot, right? You have to solve these very, very hard problems.
Yeah.
But we felt like we were finding our own way to sort of make a little difference, right? And to do what we were doing well, do those little pop-ups. And it was something that helped us to, you know, continue to sort of like grow that approach of doing this like pop-up tour. That then led to me being recruited to Uber. And it's funny, it's maybe one of the first times where I really sat with it and asked myself, why are you doing this? What are you intending to get out of it? What are you wanting to accomplish there? And really making an informed decision. And there's a lot that went into it. One, I was told that it had a real culture of entrepreneurship, right? Which is an environment in which I thrive. And so I thought, okay, amazing. If I have interesting ideas, I can come in and do them, right? Like that's what I was told. Frankly, you know, it was a big problem to solve. I like ran into the fire, right? And I think part of that is, you know, my background as a lawyer, but also as an entrepreneur, which is also about being a problem solver and thinking like, you know, I want to be a part of solving this problem. And that problem was really around workplace culture and brand as it pertains to women in the workplace. That was my focus, right? And what was the impact that I was intending to have was sort of in that space. The other critical things were, you know, I was still doing phenomenal and I wanted to get a front row seat to building a business. I looked at this as a sort of mini MBA opportunity to do that, to build up that expertise in a credible institution where after however many, you know, years I decided to be there, that I could come out saying, I've done brand work, right? I'm not just kind of out here learning as I go, right? And so that was very thoughtful about that and very strategic. Like it was super clear in my mind, in part because I was choosing to leave doing phenomenal. Right. I was deciding, all right, I'm gonna go back into tech. And if I'm gonna do that, like I need to be very clear about why I'm doing this.
Okay. So at Uber, you were the head of strategy and leadership, which sounds like a really phenomenal position, but I have to be honest, I don't really know what that means. So could you tell me a little bit about the job, the responsibilities, what you were overseeing, all of that stuff?
Yeah, it was really brand work, right? They had a lot of challenges, and I think the observation that I had and really the experience that I've had in other early stage startups is a common one, which is you're building fast, you're moving fast, you're breaking things, as was the motto at Facebook early on, move fast and break things. And, you know, the fact of the matter is when you have an entrepreneurial culture, that can be really great. It can help a business grow very fast and do extraordinary things, but sometimes or oftentimes perhaps it comes at the cost of other things that you are not thinking about while you're, you know, moving fast and breaking things, which are culture, which are, you know, how you treat your employees, which are diversity, equity, and inclusion. All of these, you know, things that folks are now starting to value in a more clear way. But the fact is, like, if you think about those things after the fact, it's too late oftentimes. And then you have to go back and really do hard, hard work to sort of, you know, fix it. And the right way to do it, my feeling is that you bake it in from day one, which is really the whole sort of challenge and, you know, hypothesis of like what we're doing at Phenomenal, which is that you can do that and you can build a really influential, powerful, you know, successful business by doing that. So that's what the work was. It was that sort of internal and external brand engagement, brand management. And at the time that I left, it was another lesson for me that I also learned a little bit. I learned way down the road about this at, you know, Facebook, but, you know, these companies change and they evolve, you know, the product evolves, their impact on the world changes. And, you know, I think it's important for people to be mindful of that. And there came a point where I felt like I had learned what I wanted to learn. I had, you know, done what I wanted to do, and I felt good about that. And the company was sort of shifting in ways that I was not as interested in. And I really also made an informed decision at that point, like, all right, do I want to stay here, right? And is this sort of a signal that this is time for me to really try to go do my own thing? And, you know, it's interesting, as I said, I had that experience with Facebook, but I didn't really learn it until much later, which is that we were building this social network and it was a way to, you know, share your, you know, day-to-day with your friends and stay connected. I then went on to become a, you know, data privacy cybersecurity lawyer and learned about like consumer protection and, you know, targeted advertising. And we were all warning everybody about what the, you know, worst possible uses of, you know, technology are. And, you know, lo and behold, you know, fast forward to the 2016 and 2020 elections. And we all know right now the power of that. And so it's just wild, the use of technology and how that evolves. And it was just an interesting experience to think about, like, you know, what are my principles and where do I want to contribute value and spend my time and what is my impact on the world ultimately, not to be corny.
Absolutely. And I think the other part of it is it's values, it's skill set, it's what you want to learn, it's how you want to grow. I mean, even on a much more benign level over the 15 years of Who, What, Where, we've had people, like, as the company has evolved, it's no longer a fit for them. And that's okay. Like, some people evolve and continue to thrive, and other people say, like, hey, this was great, but I think we're at the end of the road for what I want to do. And that is totally acceptable, no matter where you are, no matter what the industry, whether it's values or skill set or, you know, the company's trajectory, whatever it is. It's okay to say, I signed up for something, I've done it, and now it's time.
Right. And also to your point that, you know, as companies grow, necessarily, you know, the culture and the day-to-day does change, right? Like, that's, yeah, that was another big learning for me, which was finally understanding that I really do thrive in sort of very early stage entrepreneurial environments. And when we're talking about, you know, much bigger corporate, you know, environment, that is not where I thrive, right? And to the point you're making, that if you come into a company early and it grows significantly, right, you might see both sides of that. And it's okay to understand and evaluate, right, like, where do you fit in a meaningful way?
Okay, so let's talk about 2020, because obviously it goes without saying, an incredibly challenging year for everyone. But it was also a really pivotal year for you career-wise. You left Uber, you published a book, and you launched Phenomenal Media and Phenomenal Productions in a big way. What was going on in your head to make all of this happen?
Yeah, I mean, it was a combination of things, as is sort of always the case. I think I had felt like I contributed what I wanted to, and that I had, you know, learned what I wanted to at Uber and sort of accomplished what I set out to do. But really, honestly, you know, another big, big factor was then looking at Phenomenal, which was still just taking off, right? I mean, over the last, it's now been 4.5 years, but the 3.5 years that I was doing it sort of on the side, it was just growing. I joked that, like, I couldn't get away from it. I tried multiple times, including when I went to Uber. I was like, all right, I made the decision to go back to tech, kind of like let this thing sit here, you know, and let it be a passive thing. I just could not get away from it. And I had my first kids book coming out on June 2nd. And my last day was June 1st. And I think for me, it was really like just the fear. Like, it wasn't just an easy, like, all right, okay, now's the time. Like, I'm going to go build this thing. If I had been able to do that, I would have done that like 3 years before that. But having the book, I think, ended up being that sort of like concrete thing, at least psychologically, that I could say, all right, this is the thing that I am focusing on. So it allowed me to like really pour myself into that and have that be a really meaningful experience that then, you know, opened me up to doing what I'm doing now, which is obviously running the business full time, which has been just a wild ride and just really gratifying to do it finally.
How do you know when it's the right time to launch a new campaign or product or arm of the business?
I don't think that you ever really know if it's the right time. Things shift so quickly these days. Like, we're actually looking at launching a really massive campaign in the next 3 weeks. And especially when you're doing work around, you know, culture or, you know, social issues or sort of national dialogue, like all the different things that we tap into and are about, you know, really seizing that moment. Nowadays, with things shifting so fast, it's hard to even, you know if something's relevant 1 week, if it's going to continue to be relevant next week, or if the conversation's going to be still what we thought it was. So it is this ability to, you know, kind of spring in urgent moments and to, you know, be nimble to do that. A lot of it is also listening, right? Understanding what people are needing and wanting, and really tapping into, you know, community in that way. I mean, our perspective is always really providing a differentiated, unique, nuanced POV on something that is about centering underrepresented communities.
Right.
So inherently, if it relates to an underrepresented community, then more likely than not, you know, it's an issue or a way of looking at an issue that is not, you know, widely represented. And that's the work that we do, which is, how do you amplify that, elevate that? How do you showcase the work that may be happening behind the scenes or on the ground that has not sort of reached a mass audience, and think about that from sort of a creative marketing, promotional brand perspective. And equal pay was the first one, right? Yep. It was really us proactively pushing that, us understanding, you know, this is a huge issue that affects underrepresented communities, in particular women of color, in really distinct ways. And we want to do everything that we can, you know, with our brand to make sure that people are aware of that. We really, you know, came back to that issue over and over and over again. And I think it shows the power of, you know, again, being able to commit to that and prioritize and understand that it's ongoing work, and it's not just, you know, one day per year or one campaign that you do on any given issue.
So in addition to all of this, your second book came out in January, Ambitious Girl, which I bought from Semicolon and had shipped to us. So I was like, support an independent bookstore. I read it with my daughter, who's 1.5. Just as importantly, in my opopinion, I read it with my son, who's 3.5. It is so wonderful. We have your first book too. We read that one as well. What is the process of writing a children's book like? Because to me, it feels very intimidating in a way, because we all have these memories of the children's books that we loved as kids. And also, I think people probably think, oh, it's kids, like it's easy to do. But in fact, I think it's very complicated to distill these really adult ideas down to age-appropriate, digestible language that's still inspiring for kids. So what is your process like?
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest challenges for me, and what was so interesting about my first go at this with the first book, was like, I'm a creative. I am an artist. I always used to say, like, I'm an artist first, even though I've done, you know, we talked so much about like all the lawyer stuff. And what was so interesting is lawyers are not known for being brief. And you know, I come to my writing oftentimes like approaching it like a legal brief, right? Like with footnotes, and like, it's a lot. And that's just sort of how I was trained to write. But on the other hand, as I said, I'm a creative and I'm also very visual. And what is so fascinating is that the book, my first one, what stayed true from like draft one in my early sort of brainstorming to final product was the illustrations and the images and imagery and like turning each page and what you see. I, of course, didn't illustrate it myself, but I had sketched out sort of like, here's what I see on the page, right? What did not stay true was I had to cut down like paragraphs of words that were just like, you can't, you know, read this to kids. So that is interesting and challenging, right? And so much of it is what you don't say. So much of it is the illustrations. It is, you know, getting across sort of feeling and emotion and situating yourself within that story or that character with very few words. And it is definitely hard. What I'm really proud of, you know, talking about this whole journey, as much as I'm all about now, you know, ambitious girls and ambitious women and, you know, naming it and claiming it and not hiding it. Of all of my ambitions, like being a kids book author was incredibly not on my bucket list. It's almost, I hate the term imposter syndrome, but it was definitely this like sort of not willing to call myself an author. Like, I'm not a real author. Like, I'm not like, you know, I'm just doing a fun thing for my family and it's cute or whatever, but like, I'm not like a real author. And that's so silly, right? Like, of course I'm a real author. And you asked about the process, and something that has been helpful to me is really thinking about, you know, similar to Phenomenal, like, what is my mission, right? Like, what is my purpose in doing this? And for me, it is, you know, continuing commitment to underrepresented communities and voices. For my kids' books in particular, it's about centering main characters who are little Black girls who are often not on the pages of books, certainly not, you know, the protagonist through whose, you know, eyes and experiences you're seeing the world and the story unfold. And again, that was really me becoming a parent and seeing that lack of diversity generally. And so we were doing things like coloring the skin in with a brown marker, or, you know, all the time changing pronouns from he or she or they. Now that they're a little bit older, I'm the like annoying mom that will like pause a movie or pause as we're reading, like, oh, did you notice? Like, we don't know any of the women's names. We only know the men's names in the book. Isn't that weird? Or why don't the women speak? Or where are the women?
Where are the women?
Like, what the hell, you know? And man, it's funny. I mean, like, when you do that, they really do start to, you know, bring that critical eye to their, you know, observations. And it's really amazing to see that, especially with my older daughter.
Yeah. So we like to talk about mistakes on this podcast because everyone makes them and not everyone talks about it. And I'm tired of it because it's very normal and we need to normalize making and learning from mistakes. So what's a mistake that you've made in your career and what have you learned from it?
Gosh, I made lots of mistakes. For me, honestly, the most important thing is like, and I'm actually really proud of myself on this, which is like reframing mistakes as opportunities to learn and to test and to, you know, get better. And my, you know, experience has been that you have to, right? Like that is the process of being an entrepreneur, of building something new, is understanding and accepting that you're going to make mistakes, that things are not going to go according to plan, right? And really embracing that. And so, you know, I can point to, as I said, lots and lots of mistakes that I've made. The one that comes to mind is it was early days at Facebook, and it was me and Chris Hughes and a couple other people, but not many, that were like big, big Obama people, right? Mm-hmm. And you can imagine me, this is a company of like 20-year-olds back then, especially 20-something-year-olds are not super involved in politics typically. But I was like out there. I was very aggressively a big Obama supporter at a time when, you know, people were not yet, this was like in 07. So looking back, you know, and I was what, I was like 22 or something. I was a kid, but, you know, I feel like there were different ways that I could have approached that in the workplace that not only would have been more effective of me like getting more support for Obama, but also like thinking about, you know, how people view you in a work setting, right? So anyway, there's just things like that are kind of like professional sort of like development things. As I said, I make mistakes all the time. Everybody does. And I think it's really about embracing them as challenges. And to be clear, challenges not just that, you know, prevent you from doing something or that, you know, hold you back. You know, it's about a challenge of truly powering through it, right? And coming out on the other side of it. And you're bound to, you know, make mistakes. And that's part of the process of testing and iterating and learning.
So a lot of the people who listen to this podcast are in their first life. They want to do something else. They want to switch lanes. They want to switch industries. They want to switch careers, but they haven't quite figured out how to do that. Maybe they're a little scared. Maybe they're nervous. Who knows? What advice would you give someone who wants to make a pivot in their career, but hasn't really done it quite yet?
Absolutely. I think what is so important is to identify, you know, where you want to pivot, obviously, right? And even if it's not fully baked, right? I'll speak from personal experience. When I was at my law firm in DC, Nick and I were dating at that time. He was in New York, I was in DC, and I was trying to decide, like, you know, do I want to stay here in DC and kind of keep doing this law firm thing, or do I want to move in with him in New York? Even at that time, I was like, do I want to do marketing or like media? Like, I knew that I was interested in those things, which of course I'm doing now. But I had no idea what that even meant. And ultimately, in that moment, I was too scared to just like throw myself into it. But, you know, it ended up coming back 5 years later with what I'm doing now. And I think really what enabled me to make that pivot was that I had kept up my, you know, sort of creative passions on the side, however I could, no matter how small, no matter, you know, how unclear they were in terms of what I wanted to turn them into. It was just something that I kept up and I nurtured. And there's a variety of ways, I think, for people that are looking to make a pivot or have other interest areas where you can do that, even if you're not able to go, you know, make that full leap in that moment in time, which is, you know, there's tons of resources now that I didn't have many, many years ago, like YouTube tutorials or like these master classes, right? There's just so much out there to like nurture and keep up those interest areas and to learn, right? To learn about, you know, what different opportunities or lines of work or, you know, spaces maybe that may be interesting to you and explore them.
So my last question is my favorite question, which is, if you could go back in time and talk to younger Mina at any point in her career and give her a little work advice, what would you say?
I would say everything's going to be okay. Everything's going to be all right. Like, I spent so much time sort of stressing about who I was going to be and what I was going to do and what people would think and accomplishing it on a certain sort of timeline or, you know, a certain mold of achievement and success. And I think, you know, most of us hopefully are going to be fortunate to live, you know, long lives, and you have time to figure it out. You know, I think I would have told myself what I just said as well, which is like, keep that stuff up and, you know, just like be open to change and to opportunity and be, you know, flexible to see a different path if that's sort of what, you know, presents itself to you. And you never know when that moment will happen. You really, really never know. And, you know, there's some saying about, you know, sort of being prepared to meet opportunity or something corny like that, but it's kind of true, right? Like, so yeah, I think just like being kind, a little bit kinder to myself, putting a little bit less pressure on myself to be successful, whatever I thought that meant, right? Like, I think that that is something I would have told myself earlier on too.
Mina, it has been a delight in our conversation. It has been a delight watching your career from afar since we met at South By all those years ago. I cannot tell you how much I've enjoyed talking to you.
This has been so fun. There's just nothing that makes me more happy than to have these sorts of conversations. So thank you for that opportunity.
That was the best-selling author and founder and CEO of Phenomenal, Mina Harris. For more inspiring interviews with women like Mina, head on over to secondlifepod.com where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social, so be sure to tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, the show's at Second Life Pod. Our DMs are always open. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.